Okay, so let's unpack this. We are moving way past the simple storybook myth of, a jolly old man in a red suit.
Right.
The sources we have today detail something, well, something far grander, far more strategic, and frankly, a profile of almost terrifying supernatural power. Our mission today is to do a deep dive into the true origins and the global mission of Santa Claus, who we also know as Saint Nicholas.
And for you, the listener, it's crucial to set this baseline immediately. According to our sources, Santa Claus is arguably the single most powerful earthly supernatural being of all time,
Right.
second only to the Son of God, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
This isn't just some high-ranking magical figure. He is a strategic demi-archangel saint,
Yeah.
actively marshaling the forces of light against universal darkness.
Exactly. We're going to get into his miraculous supernatural birth, his life as a human angel hybrid, the brutal betrayal by his dark twin brother.
Which is a huge part of this.
A huge part. And his dramatic resurrection, and maybe most importantly, the incredibly stringent supernatural laws that govern his global mission and, constrain the very use of his vast power.
And what's so fascinating here is the existential threat that underpins his entire existence. The sources frame Christmas not merely as a holiday, but as the definitive spiritual antithesis of Samhain, of Halloween, and Dark Christmas.
It's a necessary event.
It is a necessary annual marshaling of the forces of light, of truth, justice, and happiness, just to maintain the universal balance.
And I think the core takeaway we have to carry through this whole dive is this. The sources claim Santa's life shadows the life of Jesus Christ. It includes a preordained supernatural birth, a fatal betrayal leading to his death, and then a heavenly resurrection into a new, powerful form.
A destiny engineered for the greatest conflict imaginable.
It really is.
So let's start that destiny right at the beginning.
Yeah.
The angelic lineage is the foundation for, well, for everything.
Okay, so Nicholas was born on March 15th, 270 AD in Patara, Lycia, which is in modern-day Turkey. He came from a wealthy Greek family, and he would later be known, of course, as Nicholas of Myra. But his father, Archangel Sarandiel, was the true anomaly here.
Sarandiel was an incredibly high-ranking angel, but, and this is important, one of non-human origin, placed on Earth for a holy mission. And during his time here, he formed a deep bond with Nicholas's mother, Marcia of Patara.
And the lineage on Marcia's side is incredibly significant, too. The sources claim she was a verified direct descendant of Mary, the mother of Jesus Christ. So, Nicholas carried holy DNA from two of the most powerful lines in
And
existence.
this union was generally forbidden. This is the kind of thing between angels and humans that typically results in the corrupted Nephilim you read about in ancient texts.
Right.
But this case was unique. The sources are extremely clear. The entire archangel hierarchy blessed this predestined match. And that blessing meant the resulting children were not Nephilim, but what the sources classify as holy demi-angels. They were meant for greatness.
And there were twin sons, Nicholas and Claudius. Tragically, this is where that destiny just immediately fractured. Sarandiel completed his holy mission and was recalled back to heaven.
And with the archangel's protective mantle gone, a profound vulnerability opened up for Marcia. The dark forces, they immediately moved to exploit this opening, and Marcia was tricked into giving up Claudius, setting him immediately on the path of damnation in the dark demonic arts. The twins' paths split right at infancy.
So while Claudius started this horrific descent, Nicholas displayed his intended goodness. For the first 73 years of his life, he was known as Nicholas the Wonder Worker. He was famous for his anonymous secret gift-giving, his charity for the poor, and performing genuine
I mean,
miracles.
we're talking about the resurrection of slaughtered children,
Yeah.
real, tangible miracles.
And yet, despite his angelic DNA, he had very limited access to his archangel powers for those 73 years, and this was by choice.
Yes, by design. At a crucial moment of spiritual wisdom at age 33, he took a solemn vow. He would use the power of faith and spiritual strength rather than his own innate superhuman abilities. He chose to live as a spiritual human leader, becoming the beloved Bishop of Myra.
So if we connect that back to the whole narrative, that human life, that vow of humility, it was like a rite of passage.
Unnecessary tempering.
Exactly, a tempering to prove he was worthy of the full, unrestrained power that would come later.
Precisely. But that tempering process ended abruptly and brutally.
Which brings us right into the central tragedy of this whole story, the betrayal. On December 6, 343 AD, at the age of 73, Nicholas was killed by his twin brother, Claude.
And at this point, Claude was a fallen demi-angel, but not yet the titanic Anti-Claus he would become. This moment sealed his fate and irrevocably shifted the cosmic balance.
And the sources are clear. Killing a demi-angel is almost impossible. The standard methods involve things like beheading with specific mystical weapons or, you know, complete incineration by pure unholy fire.
Claude used a method that was meticulously crafted to violate Nicholas's very core. He found Nicholas praying before a statue of Jesus in the Myra Church. He pulled out an unholy, mystical sword made of coal.
Symbolic of coldness, of darkness, the absence of light and warmth.
Completely. And he thrust that black blade right through Nicholas's holy heart.
And the ritual was compounded too. The sources explain that the sword had been coated with Claude's own twin blood, combined with the brother's betrayal, piercing a heart that was dedicated to faith. I mean, this violated the highest spiritual covenants. It made the killing permanent.
Before he collapsed, Nicholas's final, incredibly powerful act was one of ultimate mercy. He whispered, "Brother, I love you, and I forgive you for your sins."
And Claude's response, a snide snicker, just a final rejection of light, which the sources note sealed his fate as the Anti-Claus and completely replaced his remaining angelic DNA with demonic DNA.
Nicholas's soul was transported to heaven immediately. He reunited with his father, Sir Randiel, who by then had been promoted to full archangel status. And he also had a brief preordained meeting with Jesus Christ. And this is where the standard rules of destiny just change.
Right, because typically when a soul of that caliber dies, it achieves nirvana or unifies with its parallel selves across the multiverse. But Nicholas wasn't unified. Why the exception?
Because he still had a great Earth-critical destiny to fulfill in our specific multiverse. So on December 25th, his father returned his soul to Earth and resurrected him. Nicholas awoke in a magically protected crypt in a new body.
A fresh, powerful vessel.
Exactly. Created using the DNA that was harvested from his corpse.
So he's resurrected. He's returned to power. What was the terrible cosmic cost of this transformation? There's always a cost.
And this is the terrifying paradox.
Yeah.
The price of his ascension. Upon his return, he was now Santa Claus, a rare half-archangel imbued with extra, specialized heavenly powers. However, because of that original symbiotic bond of the twins, the Anti-Claus rose commensurately in dark power.
Oh, wow.
Claude became a rare and exceptionally dangerous demiarch demon, second only in infernal power to the dreaded Antichrist.
That is the highest price for his power. Nicholas's greatest act of light simultaneously necessitated the creation of an entity second only to the ultimate evil.
The balance was maintained, but at a catastrophic high-stakes level. And that conflict required an anchor. His original corpse was a powerful artifact.
And the sources say his original bones were stolen centuries later by the Anti-Claus, right?
Yeah.
In a desperate attempt to use the relics to turn Santa mortal.
They were. They were recovered. And now they are hidden in a heavily protected, magically sealed crypt under the St. Nicholas Church in North Pole City. They literally act as the physical anchor to keep Santa's current powerful body tethered to this specific reality.
So now we have the fully realized demi-archangel saint ready to defend the Earth. Let's talk about the raw power set he commands, because this is not simple parlor trick magic.
No, this is celestial operational force.
He is, as we said, the most powerful physical entity on our planet. But his power isn't drawn from just one single source. It's a triune convergence.
He draws immense strength from his archangel half, which lets him use Enochain Angel Magic, a highly sophisticated language-based system of creation that only high-ranking celestial beings can use.
And then there's his sainthood status, which grants him access to the collective consciousness and spiritual power of human souls.
And finally, he's a conduit for the spirit of Christmas itself. A powerful, benevolent, supernatural holiday spirit.
So with this massive power base, the sources suggest he could easily become a god in jest, unilaterally take over Earth to bring forth immediate peace and paradise. But he doesn't. Why not?
Two critical governing restrictions. First, the core edict of heavenly neutrality forbids him from taking over Earth. Humanity has to forge his own path.
Free will.
And second, and this is crucial, he must constantly temper his own strength to avoid violating the rules of the secrecy pact and, more directly, to avoid selfishly increasing his twin brother, the Anti-Claus's, hellish power.
That dual relationship is the ultimate check and balance. But even operating under these extreme constraints, the scope of his psychokinetic abilities just challenges the fundamental laws of physics as we understand them.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about specific powers like retrocognition, telekinesis, zoopathy, the ability to control animals, and, most critically for his mission, chronokinesis, control over the flow of time.
And that chronokinesis is the key to his operational success, isn't it? It's not about large-scale historical shifts. It's about micro-adjustments in time flow.
Exactly. Just what's necessary to deliver gifts globally in one night while remaining completely invisible and still adhering to the laws of physics.
And he also has the ability to see all non-corporeal beings. I mean, gods, fairies, demons, djinn, poltergeists.
Anything that would normally be invisible to the human eye and even to most paranormal eyes. He sees the entire spiritual landscape of the earth at all times.
Incredible. So let's move to his operations. After his resurrection, he went stealth, establishing what was North Pole Village and is now North Pole City. And it's cloaked, right?
It has to be. It's cloaked by a powerful Enochain angel magic spell as the modern technological world expands and encroaches.
And his famous reindeer, they were originally just normal earthly creatures before his death.
That's right. Used for snow travel. Post-resurrection, he enchanted them with his archangel powers, allowing them to fly and granting them sentient intelligence and speech. Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, and the rest, they are highly intelligent, aware operatives who help him navigate multidimensional barriers.
And the elves. The sources explain they were originally a nomadic group who sought Santa out because their whole culture dictates they love to work for the greater good.
And once they were vetted and brought in, Santa blessed them wholly, transforming them into special enchanted elves. This process made them far more powerful than their traditional counterparts and also granted them immortality.
They started around 100, and the current count is, what, 221?
221, managing the most complex magical manufacturing operation in the entire world. It's a completely self-sustaining, immortal, enchanted operation.
And speaking of immortality, the sources also detail his family life. He married his soulmate, Holly Mrs. Claus, in the 18th century.
But since immortals like Santa can only have offspring with angels or higher beings, to keep the lineage pure light source DNA, the archangels had to intervene. They granted them two children, Nicholas Jr. and Mary.
And they're both immortal, age extremely slowly, so they're basically having the longest childhoods of all time.
All time. Plus, they adopted a human elf son named Sandy, and they have Sparky, the ever-living Dalmatian, a highly protected, highly unique family unit.
Okay, let's shift now to the constraints of his mission, which is maybe the most intriguing piece of policy in this whole dive. The universal reliance on a balance between good and evil is central, and Christmas is the key holiday to counterbalance the dark forces plotting the War of Armageddon.
This brings us to the Great Trial. In the early days, right after his resurrection, Santa was delivering gifts to all good children across Europe and the Middle East, and he planned to expand globally. Cover the whole nice list.
And this expansion triggered a massive controversy.
A huge one. He was immediately charged by demons, naturally, but also by a significant faction of angels, all claiming he was violating the Supernatural Secrecy Pact of 33 AD.
And that pact was established to ensure humanity followed its own path without large-scale paranormal interference to protect free will.
So Santa was forced into a rare celestial trial. His argument was that he was just rewarding good behavior, not interfering with conflict. But the opposing side argued that delivering magical gifts to the general populace, even good children, was too great a spiritual influence.
And the verdict forced a massive compromise. Santa was ordered not to interfere directly in global affairs or deliver gifts to the general populace. He was restricted to the supernatural community and a tiny number of very exceptional human beings.
So who actually gets presents directly from the demi-archangel saint today?
It's limited to the good members of the paranormal community. So, you know, vampire slayers, werewolf hunters, ghostbusters, magic practitioners, as a reward and a morale booster for fighting evil.
And as a concession, only a handful of exceptionally good non-supernatural children whose goodness is just too pure and great to overlook.
This forced him to find a brilliant workaround for the rest of humanity, and that's where the spirit of Christmas comes in. He uses this spirit to compel parents and others to give presents in his holy name.
Marshaling the magic of childhood innocence across the globe without directly violating the secrecy pact. It's genius.
But Santa is clearly not satisfied with this restriction. The sources detail his major current plan, a complex global spell that would let him deliver to everyone on his nice list while magically making parents believe they gave the gift.
It's the ultimate end run around the secrecy pact.
And this plan was awaiting angelic approval, with a planned rollout of Christmas 2020. The implication here is staggering. The fact that the heavenly archangels are even considering this suggests they may be losing faith in humanity's ability to self-govern the balance.
Forcing them to finally change their view on non-interference.
So what does this all mean? We started with the humble Bishop of Myra, and we've ended with a demi-archangel saint who, sometimes visible as the Auroras, wages full-scale magical energy beam wars against his demi-archdemon twin, the Anti-Claus.
The synthesis is that Christmas isn't a cozy tradition. It's an annual critical battlefield. Santa Claus is desperately fighting his twin, who uses a black sleigh pulled by 8 hellhounds and a demonically enchanted werewolf to maintain the universal balance so Earth can survive the War of Armageddon.
Which raises an important question for you to consider. If the purpose of Christmas is to maintain this critical universal balance, and Santa's proposed 2020 global spell risks violating the highest celestial laws, what does this aggressive strategic shift suggest about the current equilibrium? Is the balance currently failing so badly that the highest authorities are sanctioning greater magical intervention? Think about what that reveals about the escalating conflict the next time you see the northern lights flicker across the night sky.